Ooh, I wrote so tiny, I was so concentrated. Well, we started this whole business by talking about mythology in general and the part that it plays in the mysteries, where mythology is looked at as just about literal spiritual truth. Then we corrected and we looked at how sometimes mythology reads just the opposite of the way things are. And then we spent a number of weeks looking at creation stories, going under the idea that what is involved in a creation story is involved in our creativity, even in our initiation. What we experience in ourselves when we create follows a formula that is just like the creation of the cosmos. Now we've been looking at mystery myths, which are myths that were used or are used by mystery schools for bringing the candidates for initiation to a state of consciousness where they can expand their consciousness and reach deeper and higher spiritual states of consciousness. First, we looked at Isis, Osiris, and Horus, and we took the mystery myth as recorded by Plutarch. And it was a very strange and curious kind of story with all kinds of little vignettes in. But that was probably, is claimed and probably is true, the most influential of all of the mystery myths, being that most of the other mystery myths, which came later in time or in other cultures, followed basically the idea of Isis, Osiris, and Horus, which probably didn't originate with the Egyptians. It probably originated with the Atlanteans coming out of Egypt, out of Atlantis and going to the Gobi land. Or it may well have come out of Ethiopia from the Gymnosophists who migrated there early on in the, from the Indian Empire. Now that was the most influential one, and now we're going to look at the myth that is the most famous one, and it is the myth of December, yeah, Demeter and Persephone. And this myth was celebrated at mystery festivals for several thousand years. And many Greeks and later Romans and other noble people from other parts of the world, though it wasn't only noble people, sometimes it was even slaves that were initiated, took part in the celebration at Eleusis every year, and so that's over 2,000 years of celebrations.
Is Eleusis a place?
Yes, it's a place that's northwest of Athens, about 13 miles. And it started out just like Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, as it took place in a woods outside of Athens, probably a sacred grove. And because they had sacred groves that had, that had certain powers that came out of the earth and were associated with certain trees. Sometimes they were artificial. Sometimes in geometric positions they would put 12 or 13 trees in a circle, depending on whether they were making it solar or lunar months, and then they would have a tree of each specific species that needed to get the right relationship of force to each other and would do things that way. Many people had their lives changed by the Eleusinian mysteries. And almost without exception, in fact, there is no recorded exception, but I find it hard to believe that there wouldn't be one exception, but almost without exception, people lived better lives as a consequence of having experienced the mystery initiation, though not all of them experience it at the same level. We're going to talk a lot about that next week, or the next time we meet. We're going to only tell the myth tonight and then go through it a second run through and do little side trips. And then next week we're going to talk about the mysteries themselves as they were celebrated, as much as is known of them. And then we're going to look at it on three or four different levels of interpretation. In fact, we may take the classic four Platonistic levels of interpretation of a myth. The Platonists had four levels that they standardly looked at myths at. But at any rate, the myths were so profound in their moral influence that they had almost no detractors. Some people made fun of them, but it was all lighthearted because they were, because they were so profound and so many influential people, and not only influential people in terms of political power or financial power or something like that, but people who by their character were strong. One of the only people not to be initiated into them was Socrates. And he did, and that some people feel that that's why he was called a heretic. I don't agree with that. The modern mystery students say the reason Socrates was not initiated into the mysteries is because he was a medium, and mediums were not allowed to be initiated into the mysteries, at least on the deeper levels. Among the people who had positive things to say about the mysteries was the best type to look at, and that is people who were skeptical. And the skeptic had something to say about them. Diogenes, if you know who Diogenes was, he was the original cynic. He founded the school of cynicism, and he about dressed in rags, and he lived in a barrel inside the Agoria, is that how you pronounce it? I think it's the Agoria, the marketplace. And he just had all kinds of outrageous things to say. I think there's a famous story of him. There are all kinds of famous stories. One is that a boy and his father were going through the square, and I think the boy, being a spoiled, rich young brat, spit on Diogenes. So, but Diogenes walks up to him and slaps his father. Yeah. Famous story. And another one is that Plato, going through the Agoria, was wearing, he had this majestic purple robe. And Diogenes walks up to him and said, "I have stepped on Plato's pride." And Plato says, "But aren't you proud that you did it?" But this is what Diogenes had to say about the Eleusinian mysteries. He said, "A thief who has been initiated into the mysteries stands a better chance in this life and in the next, if there is such, than an honest man who hasn't been initiated." And if a skeptic says that, it's really big time stuff that you're dealing with. So If the skeptics believed that, well, just think of how the celebrants believed. Throughout all of history, all of the mysteries in all cultures, all of the right-hand mysteries, that is, have been highly revered for their influence at moral redemption and spiritual regeneration. It's universal in becoming better people and worshiping the divine and uniting with it is what it's all about. How did, what's his name, the Russian, Dostoevsky, how did he say it? God is what it's all about. We won't be very thorough about the discussion of the Eleusinian reasons, mysteries, for several reasons. And primary among those reasons is that very little is known about the mysteries in details. For the last 4,000 years, it's been one of the best-kept secrets on the face of the earth, despite the fact that hundreds and thousands of people passed through the Eleusinian mysteries none would disclose, or if they did so, they did so in a very veiled way. And we're going to see that the disclosures were almost as mythical as the myth celebrated in the mysteries. That's because, like most of the ancient mysteries, even up until the beginning of this century with Freemasonry, disclosure of secrets was done under the penalty of death. So people just didn't talk about it. Another reason we're not going to talk a lot about the mystery celebration is because it's so vast. We'd have to go into so much Greek culture and everything involved with it. And it's a very technically intricate thing. You read through these books, and you read through these books and all the information. I just don't want to sift through all of that, and even in a modified rendition. And another reason we're not going to do that is because the philosophy is no longer appropriate to our times. And we're going to discuss that in the next meeting when we get to the highest level of talking about the myth. So we're going to tell the story, and tell the story with the side trips. And then we're going to, the next time we meet, we're going to talk about the public celebrations, which were pretty wild. And then we're going to discuss it on different levels. Now, last time when we talked about Isis, Osiris, and Horus, we looked at the mystery myth from different points of view. We looked at it from the physical body and from astronomy and such like that. But this time we're going to take the same myth and go take it on different levels, because on different levels it has different meanings. All right. Having gotten all of that out of the way, we're ready to hear the story. And we note that there are a lot of similarities between this and the Isis story, because there was the cultural influence. It involves I went into the stash and got a new piece of chalk. It involves Demeter. And Demeter means barley mother. And it involves, well, we'll bring up the other ones. In Roman, it's Ceres, which we know very well from our word cereal. When we eat breakfast cereal every morning, we're eating the food of Ceres, because Demeter is not only, it was corn mother, not just barley mother, but barley mother most especially. Well, they in the European context, any grain they called corn. They don't call what we call corn, we don't call that In Europe, they call that maize.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So corn means grain.
Yes, yes. And like the mysteries of Isis, Osiris, and Horus, but with different cultural viewpoint, she is the son of Cronus. And Rhea. Probably heaven and earth, but we won't go into that. And she's part of a big, big family. The eldest of the family is Hestia. And then Demeter. And then Hera. And then Hades. And then Poseidon, and then Zeus. The first five members of the family were because of a prophecy that Cronus would be overthrown by one of his children. The first five members were swallowed immediately upon birth. Cronus ate all of his children. He swallowed them whole. That's an interesting myth in itself. I don't know if we'll go into that or not, but it's equally as interesting as Isis and Osiris copulating in the womb. But in the case of Zeus, when Zeus was born, Rhea was just so sick and tired of this whole business of losing all of her progeny that she gave Cronus a great big stone wrapped in swaddling clothes, and he swallowed the stone, and Zeus grew up to be very powerful and overthrew him. But Demeter, unlike many of the Greek gods and goddesses, was of a very gentle nature. Nothing harsh about her at all. She did very, very few hard things. But she was also quite earthy. Earthy and lustful. In fact, she was called the goddess of the cornfield for fertility rites in the cornfield. And she was also called the initiator of brides and grooms, because she was the goddess that taught them what they probably already knew since they were children. But despite the fact that she was lusty and earthy, she never was married. She's one of the only ones of the elder gods that was never married. She had a lot of lovers. Oh, after Zeus overthrew his father, he cut the stomach open
and got them all out.
they all came out alive, which is a very big myth, which is the famous one that the Platonists, I believe it is the Platonists, not Plotinus, but Proclus. I believe it's Proclus that interprets that myth on several levels. There are so many of the, in the classical times, of those very deep people. One of her early liaisons was with her brother, Zeus. She got lusty, and she had two children. One of them was Cor. Sometimes you see it with a K, sometimes with a C. And the other was Aeacus. Aeacus. And there were two children from their dalliances. They weren't twins, but they stayed together with each other quite a while. Another one of her lovers was Aeacus, who was one of the Titans. And it so happened that Adam and Eve had several Adams, Adam and Eves in the Greek stories. One set was Deucalion and Pyrrhea, and the other one was Cadmus and Harmonia. And since Cadmus and Harmonia, at least along the Promethean tradition, were the first humans, when they got married to each other, there was a grand celebration. And at this grand celebration, all the gods and goddesses attended. Gods and humans were, you know, just spent the time in the earth together. And this is when Demeter took this tremendous fascination for Aeacus, and they got so hot and bothered that they walked right out of the wedding into a rainy, muddy, thrice-plowed cornfield. And they copulated ecstatically, and they came back, and they were a sight, and Zeus noticed it, and he got very, very jealous and upset about it, so he took the thunderbolt, and he killed Aeacus. But out of that union came Plutus. Oops. Not Pluto, but Plutus, where our word Plutarchy comes from. Plutus in the Greek means wealthy. This was the sort of a lower level god of wealth. And there's another story that we're going to come up with along the way, and that is during her sorrow, when her daughter is missing, she's traveling all over, and her other brother gets lustful toward her, Poseidon, and he just bothers her and bothers her, and she just will have nothing to do with him because she's grieving over the loss of her daughter. And so what she does is she goes into this farmer's pasture and turns herself into a mare. And Poseidon, who among all of the gods had produced more